I feel like I've been at this for a long time. I hate to say the word veteran, but I don't know. I feel like the amazing thing is being around like young content creators. I'm constantly rejuvenated. They inspire me. I think this generation of content creators, I'll say this again, they will, in a 7-game series, beat our old generation in a sweep 4-0, like every single day. They're more creative, they're more innovative, and they're better than our generation when we first started off, like hands down. It would not even be close. And it's that's why it's like my responsibility to both nurture them, invest them, and put them in a position where they can get to my executive producer level like way sooner than I got it at my age.
This is the Creative Sports Podcast. My name is Justin Peterson. And joining me are Garrett Wright.
God bless the screw-ups for they provide us intro content.
And Brock Rahm.
I think you're hitting the nail on the head. You have to be active about it because it's just not going to fall on your lap.
Changing expectations and meeting fans where they are. Overtime is making a name for themselves in the industry by catering to their audience of young fans. So what does the future look like? Today we have Overtime executive producer Bernard Worrell here to help us understand the youth movement.
Brock, what do you want to clap on here?
Let's do 43.
All right.
Good enough.
Get this thing rolling.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the show. My name is Garrett Wright. I want to start out with a big thank you to APM Music for donating the tracks we use on this podcast. Also, a reminder that this podcast is an extension of the sports creative community on Slack, so if you're hearing this and not a member of that community yet, you should head over to sportscreativeslack.com and sign up for free.
So today we're joined by Bernard Worrell, who is the executive producer at Overtime, and the reason we wanted to bring you on to have this conversation is because you have an interesting demographic and an audience that you're trying to hit with your content. And you've been in the industry for a little bit. So first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you, guys. Happy to be here. I was quite surprised. And so I'm kind of honored to be one of your guests. So I know, Justin, you and I have been sort of connected on LinkedIn for quite some time now. So happy to meet, even though if it's virtually, but happy to be on. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Can we start with understanding a little bit of your background and how you initially got into the content creation space?
Yeah, sure. So I'm born and raised in Israel, lived there the majority of my life. Pretty much grew up playing soccer and tennis. Those are sort of like the sports I kind of got into. If you grew up anywhere outside of the United States, if you don't play soccer, you have zero chance of having any friends or any social interaction at school whatsoever. So soccer was obviously huge. I actually did not really get into basketball until my family. We moved to Honduras when I was 10 years old. We lived there for about 2 years. So moving to a whole new country, new language, needed to learn Spanish, which is at the time, well, now it turns out to be a great luxury. So now I speak, obviously, Hebrew being my first language, English my second language, and Spanish. So got into watching basketball. When I moved to Honduras, because they had American television and they had the NBA games all the time. So I started watching inside stuff on the weekends and all that kind of great basketball games. So instead of watching basketball on tape delay back in the late 80s and all that kind of stuff, and during the Jordan years, I got to watch live games and I got hooked into basketball and then kind of took over my love for soccer. Then moved over to Croatia, where I lived there for about a year. During the war in the Balkans, and then my love for passion and for basketball even grew because basketball was huge in Croatia at the time. They just finished off in the Olympics with that losing to the Dream Team in the, I believe it was in the semifinals. Obviously, the classic story about Tony Kukoc, you know, going up against Jordan and Pippen and all that kind of stuff. You know, one of the heroes of Croatia at the time was Drazen Petrovic. I may have a story because I'm a huge Laker fan, loved Magic Johnson. I was crushed the year before because Magic Johnson just retired from the NBA. I remember playing with some local guys in Croatia and they were like, you know, like hailing like Drazen Petrovic is the best player of all time. And I was like, what are you guys talking about? Like, I was like, Magic Johnson is the best point guard of all time. And I literally almost got like beaten up on a basketball court. So that's where my love for sports and basketball sort of came about. Then obviously I moved back home to Israel. I went to college, went to the army for 3 years. And then during that time, I've always wanted to get into the basketball, specifically the NBA, which was crazy. A kid from Israel, that was my goal, to like find a way to work in the NBA in some capacity. Fast forward, I moved over to the U.S., went to college, started in a degree at health science, which my parents were very happy about. But midway through that, I kind of started writing for a newspaper at my school, started writing articles. And at the time, journalism was kind of like a thing, you know, print and all that kind of stuff. And kind of told my parents, hey, I'm squashing this health science kind of thing. I'm going to go into journalism. And my parents were like, yeah, sure, go ahead and do it. I ended up moving to Miami, where I went to Florida International University, where they have an undergrad program for broadcast journalism specifically. And my path kind of started from writing newspapers to my next step was getting into working for our yacht magazine. I was a huge Slam magazine fan. So I always like that was like sort of my early aspirations of writing for Slam magazine. So shout out to Lang Whitaker, who was one of my great followers back in the days. And then obviously I got an internship sort of in a local news station down in Miami. I was also working for a college radio station. I was doing women's basketball games. I was producing and color analyzing and stuff like that. I just wanted to get like sort of create a path. So once I'm ready to sort of get like a full-time job, I would have the experience. So I was like lining myself up from like newspaper, magazine, radio, local TV. And then that one summer right before my senior year, I got hired as an intern to work for the Florida Panthers for their production department. At that time, I went back home to Israel for the summertime. And when I flew back to the U.S., I landed, got a voicemail from the lady who hired me. And she apologized because I guess I didn't even realize, but hockey, the NHL was at a strike at that time. And unfortunately, that meant like no internship for me. But at the same voicemail, she says, but don't worry, my husband works at the Miami Heat. And I already spoke to him and I've got an interview lined up to him. Let me know if you're interested. The whole time I'm listening to this voicemail, and it went from like crushed to all of a sudden like, holy smokes, like, I can't believe this. Like, I've got like what I've always wanted to do. So I didn't know much about hockey, but I figured like this is my, you know, my entrance into like the sports world. And eventually I use that to get into the NBA. So now I'm skipping the NHL and going straight into the NBA. So my last senior year in college, I basically was interning for the Miami Heat. I've had two classes, so I had plenty of time to devote all my time to them. I probably spent every single waking moment from the morning till nighttime as an intern working there. I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, but I'd be going back to my dorm room at 2-3 o'clock in the morning. Like, that's how much I love being there. And by the time I graduated in December, I remember having a conversation with them like around November, you know, like every intern kind of approaches like when their semester is kind of over. It's like, hey, kind of out of conversation, you know, my semester's kind of over, I'm graduating soon. Before I finished the sentence, and like my mentor and one of my best friends, AJ Speaks, was like, don't worry about it. We got you. Let me guess, you want a job, right? I was like, yeah. It's like, we got you. We already love you. We'd love to have you. It's already in the works. Graduate. And then as soon as you're done, you got a job as soon as you're done. And now the rest was history. I started as an intern, moved up as a PA, an AP, producer, all up the ranks to my final position. Technically, my title is associate director. But I traveled with the team. I was producing live pregame shows, all that kind of stuff, studio shows. But my niche was producing features. And teases and all that kind of stuff. I think the young generation now called them hypes, but back then they were called teases. So that is how I got into the NBA, essentially. I know that was a long-winded kind of answer, but that's how it worked out. And fast forward, I spent 14 incredible, amazing years in an incredible organization and culture with the Miami Heat for 14 plus years.
That's awesome. And the background and all of that. And then after the Heat, you... the soccer part makes sense now because you went to Los Angeles Football Club. Yeah. Just talking about the, you know, that 3.5 years that you went there before you went to overtime. Right. It all gets wrapped up in your background and experience there, right?
So interesting enough, I want to say it was around 2016 or so. I think David Beckham made an announcement that Miami will have a soccer team in Miami. And as much as I loved my time in the Heat, I was already starting to look forward to like, what could be like my next thing? Because obviously like I knew that there's a glass ceiling or like, you know, I've reached probably where I could reach the most in my time in Miami. And I wanted to like figure out like what's next. And so what I was doing is I was in the off season of the NBA, I would spend my time at Univision basically shadowing their production for soccer. So I figured I'd put myself in a position because all I knew was basketball and the NBA. And I didn't want to put myself in a position when that opportunity would present itself with whatever team Miami would have in soccer that would say, hey, we were looking for somebody to have the soccer back. So I was spending my off seasons basically shadowing a director and producer at Univision. They were doing MLS games and other Liga MX games and all that kind of stuff. And I literally was just sitting there in their control room. They were doing Remy shows and I was sitting on the floor and just like watching and observing. And at some point, you know, the director was cool enough to kind of let me like kind of chime in on stuff, whatever, which was great. And then fast forward, you know, at the time, now my incredible, beautiful, supportive wife was living in California in Los Angeles. And I was doing the long distance between Miami and California. So the writing was on the wall for me to eventually move to California and Los Angeles. So I was working my way to try to find a job. Fast forward, it's All-Star Weekend in the NBA. I'm in Los Angeles. I had a meeting with a certain network out in LA for a position. So I had a suit. Everything was ready to have a meeting with them. I had a meeting and ended up like not working out. They're kind of like, hey, let's just see. Maybe in the summertime, something will come up as a freelancer. While I was in Los Angeles for this All-Star break with my girlfriend, I get a phone call from somebody at LAFC because I set my stuff out and had a friend who had a contact and he was already working at LAFC and he was kind of pitching, I've got this guy in Miami, he'd be great for this position. And here I am like getting a phone call while I'm out there in my rental car. And it's like, hey, my name is so-and-so. I wanted to talk to you about director and broadcasting for LAFC. And I'm like, oh crap. Like, all right, pulled over to the side, had a conversation with him. We set up a meeting to meet up on Wednesday for an interview because great, I already had a suit because I had that meeting earlier a couple of days ago with the other network that I was there. So it all lined up amazingly and incredibly. Had the interview on Wednesday. I flew out on Thursday out to New Orleans because we were playing the Pelicans. So I met our team after the All-Star break in New Orleans. Got a job offer on Friday, accepted it, called my boss later on that afternoon to tell him I took the job, which obviously gave me my blessings and they were aware of it all along. Put my 2 weeks in, flew back from New Orleans to Miami, started packing all my stuff up and moved out to LA. LAFC already were 2 or 3 weeks into the season of their MLS soccer season. And LAFC basically needed somebody to start off a broadcast department. At the time, they only had hired a play-by-play announcer by Max Bredos, who came in from ESPN, from SportsCenter. But they had like no other talent. Didn't have any other producers, nothing, like nothing. They had a game in about 4 weeks ahead, and they basically said, we need you to put everything together because we have a broadcast in about 4 weeks. Can you do it? That's what they told me in an interview. Obviously, I was ecstatic, and I wanted the job. I was like, yeah, of course, I can get it done, no problem. Mind you, I was all pretty much all on my own, doing everything on my own, sleepless nights, nonstop. But got it done. So that's how my experience got into LA, starting basically a department from scratch. Clearly, it wasn't as big as it is here in Overtime, but I had an incredible opportunity to be both obviously producing pregame shows, doing the games and the postgame shows, but also overseeing the entire department. But we also had a channel on YouTube TV, which was called LAFC TV, which is basically a network of 24 hours of programming of LAFC. Content nonstop. So I went from having the live broadcast experience, but now I'm getting into sort of the executive producing of, you know, putting content on a channel and doing like docuseries stuff and all that kind of stuff and futuristic episodic kind of stuff, which was great. So I kind of had this like open canvas to basically use all the skill sets that I had all into like one team, which was absolutely incredible. And I loved my entire time there and the staff that I worked with. And then fast forward to that, you know, I spent 3.5 years, almost 4 seasons there. And this incredible opportunity came in with all Overtime. One gave us an opportunity, my wife and I, to move back to the East Coast, which we kind of missed, obviously, going through the pandemic and being alone out on the West Coast. When I saw the job description for what the executive producer at Overtime was looking for, I literally was like clicking, check, checking off like everything in the job description. Like, this is exactly what I do. This is the skill set that I have, and this is what I want to do. They're looking for somebody that had the live production background, and they're looking for somebody who had like the post-production docuseries episodic kind of background. And I was the perfect candidate for them. And things moved so quickly. You know, I went through like 8 rounds of interviews with everybody from their executive producer in New York all the way to their president and CEO, Zach Weiner and Dan Porter. And the rest was history. Did the same thing, packed up all our stuff and moved cross country with my wife and our little baby and moved to Atlanta on July 1st. And now I'm overseeing a growing department of about 17 plus people and growing as we're hiring more and more people to do stuff here at Overtime down here in Atlanta. So yes, so back to Overtime. They've created Overtime Elite, which is a new team slash league with the young athletes who are in the age of 16 to 18 and sort of creating a pipeline into professional basketball, which I'm guessing you'll ask me more about OT and everything next. But that is my long journey of 17 plus years in professional sports.
That's great to hear, because I feel like my background is very similar of live and creative. I very much so focus on the live and am better at it. But I've had to focus on the creative too. And I feel like there's a separation between that now that's I don't love as much, right? Because I feel like producing is producing and directing is directing, right? Whether that's post-production or you're still telling a story, right? So, so how do you take those talents from one to the other, right? What translate and what helps you from one to the other?
That is a very, 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 very good question. I think I'm a rare, you know, my story is kind of rare coming from the background of, you know, post-production and, you know, having experience in editing and producing features and all that kind of stuff. And also having the experience in live production, you know, for us at the Miami Heat, you know, creating content from not just doing teases slash hypes, but we're also big into doing features and stuff like that on our production. Like, that was big. A lot of teams don't do that on broadcast. They just either just don't have the time, don't have the staff to do it. A lot of times they usually recycle. If something goes in arena, they'll try to recycle, put it on a broadcast, right? But for us, we were big on long features. If you ever watch Heat broadcasts there, you wouldn't be surprised to see a 4-minute feature on a pregame, and even like a 2-part series that might even be on a post-game show that's like 5, 6, or 7 minutes long, which is crazy and like unheard of. But I love that part of having the skill set and like the opportunity to both, like, because I always loved features. I, you know, doing features and storytelling is like something that I've always been passionate about. And then tying that into storytelling, right? Like, I think in your past guests, people have talked about how do you connect with the players and humanizing them and all that kind of stuff, right? So having the opportunity to tell those stories and still bring those into the broadcast is important. I think if you notice, a lot of the stuff that whether fans or even opposing teams and broadcasters learn about the opponents that they're playing for is from either reading articles about like the players and stuff like that, or watching features and stuff like that, and hearing stories about players. And they use that usually on broadcasting. So producing and doing live games, I believe it, and maybe I'm too nerdy about this, but there is an art form to it. You're not just cutting cameras and just like putting stuff out there. There is a storytelling behind it. Like whether it's a team has been struggling leading up to this particular game, or this particular player is having a breakout game, it's just coming off a breakout game, and you're telling that story. And there's stories between, whether it's a rivalry between players on two opposite teams, or maybe it's a player that's playing his former team. There's tons of stories that you can tell. The only difference is like sometimes you're doing it in an episodic kind of thing. You're doing it like in a slow kind of moving sit down interviews, and it's like 5 to 6 minutes long. And then you're kind of telling the story other in a short piece. That's why I always tell like content creators, like storytelling, you know, it doesn't have to be either long form or short form. Like, I respect people who do short form. If you can tell a story in a tease or a hype in like a minute, like that's just as good as being able to tell that story in 5 to 6 minutes of a feature, in my opinion. And the same way that if you can tell a story in a theme in a broadcast throughout the night, like a lot of teams usually have like theme nights. So you're always sort of like touching on that, whether it's in a pregame show, throughout the game in the postgame show. So I think they kind of work hand in hand. I feel like me being a production producer helped me become a better live broadcast producer and vice versa.
Yeah, that's great. And when you talk about what you were able to accomplish in LA and starting from scratch, not even like having 4 weeks to a run up to a broadcast, right?
Yeah.
I think something that is challenging within that is the access. Like when you're just listening to you talk about doing long form features, 4 minute features, 6 minute features, and maybe there's multiple within a week. Or for a single game, you know, depending on shows and different things that you have going on. How did you work that relationship and build it up to the point where you had the trust of the players, the staff, and the organization to be able to accomplish all that?
To be honest with you, with LAFC, I was very lucky because I kind of came in like guns blazing with like, this is what I'm used to at the NBA. Everything for us was like, we treated every like game and broadcast and any production that we did, like it was like a Super Bowl event. Like it was like always like a big production. Like people just thought like they just overdo it at the Miami Heat all the time. And that's what I was used to for 40 plus years. And I was not going to let like the quality of production that I was going to do at LAFC like drop, because that's what I was expected. That's what I was used to. Yeah, the budgets were a little, and the resources were much different from moving from the NBA to MLS. That's probably like the biggest adjustment that I had to adjust to and realize. But I found a way. Like, you know, I remember like the first sit down that I did with LAFC with two players, or Canadian players, Mark Anthony Kay and Dejan Jakovic. And it was with our play-by-play guy. And I think we had like five cameras running on that sit down interview. With three camera people. And I was like, I jumped behind the camera just to stand, make sure it was in focus, because that's what I was used to. Like, if we got three people, we need at least a minimum of three cameras, and we got five cameras, and we pulled cameras from all over to make it work. And people just thought I was crazy. Like, what is this guy doing? It's like, it's just a sit down interview and he's got like five cameras. But that was like the level and the sort of bar that I wanted to set to let people know, like, this is the kind of level of production that Bernard is like trying to do moving forward. And I was happy that I did that moving forward, because like once I did that from the beginning, people realized that every time Bernard put something on the schedule for us to do any kind of production, whether it was small or big, they knew that like that's what the scale of it was going to look like. And then going back to your question about access, like I feel like once I set that sort of like in tone, it was a little bit different. But then again, MLS players and NBA players are like two different animals. Like, right? Like, if you've been around dealing with NBA players, access is not always the easiest in the channels that you have to go to. And dealing with MLS, with Major League Soccer players, are a little bit more down to earth and a little bit easier to like deal with. You know, most of my interactions with NBA players were either like on the team plane in the back and all that kind of stuff, and then small little chatter that you would have with them after practice in between. People would always ask me, it's like, oh, would so-and-so know you offhand? And I was like, I'm not sure if I walk by in front of so-and-so, who I've covered at the Miami Heat for so-and-so long, would like recognize me off the bat, even though he's probably seen me on a team plane a million times, but I don't know how. But, you know, the MLS players with us, with LAFC, we spent so much time with them. We saw them so in such close proximity. We had such a rapport with them that like, it was easy. Like I could easily like message them, text them. Like I never texted an NBA player before. I didn't have any of their number. But if I needed to like, you know, confirm with a player, for instance, like, hey, I'm gonna get you tomorrow after practice, I would just text them or like DM them, and it would be like, it'd be great. So access was much better than it was at the NBA. One of the things we had to do is sometimes if we got into a point where like, okay, access was not available. I think I heard one of your interviews with somebody else. You know, we ran into this problem. We weren't getting the kind of access that we wanted to do a series with our players. So we created the series specifically about our fan base, because LAFC have one of the most incredible fan bases in all of sports, I think, not just in Major League Soccer. And we wanted to tell the stories of our fans. It was called Faces of LAFC, which obviously was also nominated for an Emmy as well, 2 years in a row, which was incredible. But fans are incredible. They're like regular people, and they'll give you all the access in the world that you want. It's like, you want to do a story about me? Like, why am I special or all that kind of stuff? They're always like kind of floored when you turn to them. But I know I love telling stories of our fans, especially our fan base of LAFC. And that series turned out to be incredible because we had so much access with people. They let us into their homes and let us into their lives. And we created great, incredible content based on that.
And how much of your, when you're doing the storytelling and the shoots and setup with a kind of limited team, right? You have three people on five cameras. Like, that's not like a...
One of those people early on was my wife, you know, because my wife is a filmmaker and a cinematographer. And I would bring her early on shoots because she knew how demanding I was and what, and I, she just knew like, and I was like, hey, love, I need you to come on this shoot. I need you to bring your two cameras with you. Cause early on, like at the time, I think I just hired one guy to be on my staff, which was incredible. And he was like the main guy that carried with me throughout before I hired another person. So believe it or not, the team that I had, LAFC, was like one full-time guy and I had another freelancer. That was our content team. We basically did all of our broadcast stuff together, and we did all of our post-production docu-series pretty much together. That was our small team right there. Me, executive producing, setting the story ideas, and he was just, bless his heart, and shout out to Ulysses Roman, which is, I think you guys should do a follow-up podcast with him as well, because he's got an incredible story of a guy who was, did not come from production, and I've basically molded into like an ultimate superstar in production, pretty much.
That's awesome. And I mean, that sounds like you guys bit off quite a bit to be able to execute and, you know, get buy-in there to make it all happen.
Yeah, we certainly did. But, you know, it's when you want, it would have been easy to just say, well, this is the resources that we have. This is the hand that we're dealt, and we'll just keep things simple and then we'll just get by. But I was just not built by that. And I have infected this incredible talented guy, Ulysses Roman, with the same crazy bug that I have in. And he was just as obsessed in making an incredible production as I am. And with just the two of us, we're able to do some really incredible, incredible work with the help of another incredible freelancer by the name of Mark Hill, who was out of LA, who happened to be his roommate and one of the most talented people I've ever worked with. And sometimes, you know, yeah, it takes an army, but sometimes you're able to do stuff with just, you know, a small group of individuals who are both incredibly talented and very dedicated. And I was fortunate enough to work with two incredible people who had the same vision and the same drive that I did and just wanted to make incredible production. And, and I'm very fortunate to have had that.
I want to, before we get into what you're doing now at Overtime, mm-hmm. I want to jump back a little bit because it's intriguing to me that you grew up in Israel and you went to school in Israel too, because a lot of tech startups seem to be starting in the Tel Aviv area and are just like massive. Pixalot comes to mind, Monday.com comes to mind. Like you could probably run down a whole list. So I'm curious, what was the experience like for you in school there? Was it very technology focused, forward thinking focused? What was that experience?
To be honest with you, I went to Israeli school for up until fifth grade or sixth grade before we moved overseas to Honduras and then off to Croatia. And then I moved back to Israel. So because I lived overseas for those 3 years, we were in an American school system, which a lot of international students do. There's usually every country that you go to, if your parents are there in the embassy or kids of like the United Nations. Like my father worked in the United Nations for a very long time, 30 plus years. So that's the reason why I traveled so much throughout my life. So every country that we went to, we always went to an American school, which had an English system. So that's how, once I got into the American school system, when I moved back to Israel, my mother put us back in the American school system. So I went to a high school in Israel called the American International School. So it was basically predominantly with international students from all over the world. So very seldom, there was a very small population of actually Israeli kids in that school. I would say maybe 15% of them. So most of my high school career over time was not with Israeli kids, but with like international kids per se. But my time in Israel, I grew up in the 90s. The 90s were a very tough time in Israel. I mean, it's growing up with suicide bombs going off on a daily basis, almost though, it seemed like every day. Buses were blowing up. Our prime minister was assassinated, I believe, in my sophomore year in high school, which was crazy. So it was very tough times. And it wasn't easy, but that was the life that I was kind of used to living in Israel at that time. I wouldn't change it for the world because it was incredible. My high school experience was probably like the best high school experience I've ever had. I've had a chance to go to school every day with people from all over the world, whether it's from South Africa, you know, parts of Europe, Asia, you name it. Like the diversity was absolutely incredible. For me, being an international person as well, it helped me. So that's what I was kind of like used to. It wasn't until I moved to the U.S. for college, which the transition to that from being an international person to moving to the U.S. was very, 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 very hard.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I think you asked me a question about my experience with like really tech savvy people, but I did not have that experience with that many. One of my good friends was very tech savvy. Now he started a startup back in Israel, but for the most part, no, most of my friends, we're not. Most of my classmates in high school were kids of ambassadors and all that kind of stuff, who then went on to become, you know, like political science majors and, you know, moved all back to different parts of the world, whether they came from, and sort of like intertwined back in their countries, and, you know, they've done amazing things. So.
Yeah. Just hearing you talk about the volatility, maybe that's not the best word, but just with everything going around outside of you growing up, has that played an influence on how you are today and how you approach what you do? It sounds like there might be some parallels there with your go-getter attitude.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I relate to a lot of people that come to this country who are either foreigners and immigrants and trying to make it in this country. I'm fortunate to now be a citizen of this country for, I lost count of how many years now, but getting my citizenship was an incredible honor, and I'm happy about that. But it was a long road to coming here and making it work. And obviously being supported by a company like the Miami Heat, who helped me obviously stay and help me get sponsored and get me through to become a legal resident and all that kind of stuff, which was incredible. But, you know, if anybody's listening to this and is a foreigner or is an immigrant to come into this country to try to make it, can probably relate that it's not easy. You know, I was kind of fortunate to sort of, you know, and that's what I sort of set myself up. I was after the Army. I was already in my early 20s when I was a sophomore in college. So while all the kids around me or the students around me in college were trying to party and do all of that stuff, I was kind of like focused on making it because I knew that my time would be very limited. I had to use every opportunity. So that's why I was very adamant about getting the experience. So it's going back to working in the newspaper and the radio station, getting those internships, because I needed to put myself in the best position, because I knew once I graduated, as an international person, you basically have 1 year to basically get that sort of work experience. I forgot the kind of visa that you're on after you finish college, but basically you have 1 year to get a full-time job, which is not easy. And it's very competitive out there, especially if you're competing with other American students and stuff like that who are graduating. And companies need to make a decision of like, hey, do I pick this international person and I have to deal with all their immigration paperwork? Or do I go for somebody who is like an American citizen and I could just hire them and I don't have to deal with half the headaches of the paperwork and the immigration kind of stuff that they have to go through? So that's why I'm so grateful for everything that Miami Heat has done for me, because I would not be here where I am without them, because they took off chance and the kids from Israel. And I've had incredible support staff at the Miami Heat who put me in this position to, one, gave me an opportunity and put me in a position to succeed. And so I never took any of that for granted. I took every day as an opportunity to improve myself and to be grateful for them for the opportunity that they gave me. And I ran with it. And nothing in that sense has changed in that sense about me. And the other thing I would say is my international experience also gave me a sense of realizing and understanding the importance of diversity. And I use that in my hiring and how I put my teams together. Like a perfect example, like when I was in LAFC in Major League Soccer, if you follow Major League Soccer, the majority of the players are Spanish speaking players. And you can't have people on your content team, which what happened in LAFC prior to me hiring this incredible content creator, producer, Ulises Roman. Like, we didn't have any Spanish speaking people on our team, I was floored by, which is crazy. So you need somebody who can understand the players, can relate to players, can help you translate stuff, even though I speak Spanish and my Spanish is good enough, but it's not as good enough as the person that that I hired. Same thing with my sideline reporter. We made sure at LAFC that we hired a sideline reporter that could both speak English and Spanish, because you can't have a sideline reporter that's like interviewing players and then you have to have a translator. That's just not a good mix. So it's important to hire people that are diverse, because I think it's one helps your team and obviously helps your production. So that was a perfect example for me at LAFC. And then just overall, I'm a strong believer in the more diverse your team is and your content team, the overall, the better production is. And I'm not just talking about people from different backgrounds, but I'm talking about gender equality and all that kind of stuff as well. I think that is just key to, to building a production and a content team overall.
Yeah, that's all really great. And you guys are in the middle of hiring quite a few roles, I think, in overtime too. So it's probably, that's probably a good transition into talking about a little bit more about what you do there as the executive producer and what you're looking to do in building out the teams. I think I've seen like 5 or 6 social media style roles, and we were talking a little bit beforehand about all the different unique types of, they're not unique, but the different types that you and I and Brock are used to from, the Instagrams and the LinkedIns and things that, were more popular when we were a little bit younger, that are kind of like the OG social media now. So can you give us a little bit more of a background on what your role is there, and then we can maybe get into a little bit more specifics as far as how you're targeting audiences and how you are looking at to build out the team.
So I'm the executive producer of Overtime, specifically in our hub here in Atlanta for Overtime Elite, which is like the new basketball team slash league that started. Our first game was right on the weekend of Halloween, which is crazy. It's time has been flying by so fast. So we primarily are focusing on our digital and social platform. We've had, obviously, if you follow Overtime, and if you don't, you should. It's hard to miss. They've got 55 plus million followers across all social media platforms, which is absolutely incredible. If you follow and see this kind of the views, which, it's so crazy for my background in pro sports, what we thought was like a good amount of views on a video, whether you post it on social or whether you post it on YouTube, doesn't compare. Like, it basically would be a flop here in Overtime, which is crazy. Like, it would not, that would not do well. So that is something that I'm very incredibly proud of. We're into the type of content of, Overtime kind of started by basically, I've learned so much about this company and the people who kind of started in the beginning of basically shooting high school basketball games, like on their cell phones, like shooting it like horizontally and posting highlights of with like minimal production value to it, but still, basically understanding that this is what their fan base wanted and kept it kind of simple. And then overall realizing that their fan base was kind of like growing, and they sort of got into episodic features, kind of production. And that's when they started bringing incredible people like Mark Cohn from, Bleacher Report, and getting into doing more post-production stuff, and obviously created an incredible array with a large variety of platforms, from Overtime Season to Overtime to Overtime Next and Overtime Elite. So they've gone from shooting games with with their cell phones to now like shooting, features and episodic stuff in full production, features. And it's crazy because you think about like long form, but long form essentially is 8 to 10 minutes plus. And the biggest thing we are seeing is that our fan base, and one of the biggest things I'll tell you about Overtime that I've learned, which is absolutely incredible. Like, if you read our comments, like our social media people are so incredible. Like, bless their hearts. I can't believe, you know, the amount of time that they spend, but they're so invested in our viewers and our fan base. Like, we almost respond to like every comment on social media. Like, that's how engaged and that's how, like, you know, intertwined we are and how invested we are in our fan base and our viewers. Like, we like will respond to people and talk to them because, like, one, we appreciate their support and we know how much, and we appreciate their feedback. And we also know how important it is to be sort of connected with our fan base and our viewers. So that is the big thing that that we do. So if you notice, like, yeah, I am used to, you know, and a lot of people that I work at Overtime are used to the background of having the sort of slow episodic kind of, whether it's the Hard Knocks, the All or Nothing, those kinds of Netflix and HBO shows. A lot of us have kind of grown and watched over the years, but how do we use that sort of formula and cater it to a young audience that has a much shorter, you know, attention span? So we are very big into like motion graphics and pushing and high pumping kind of videos to kind of get our, yeah, to get our fan base kind of going. Cause you know, we realize that that's what they want. And then we constantly like listen to that. And then we keep feeding, you know, we kind of keep feeding the beast and giving them what they want. And we listen to that. And if it keeps working, then what we'll keep doing, which has been a very great learning experience for myself.
As the executive producer at Overtime, I sort of oversee two aspects of our production. One is our post-production, and the other is our live, you know, game broadcast production. From the post-production side, we are working on a season-long docuseries on our team, where basically follows all of our team from the beginning of the season, from the minute we sort of our players landed in Atlanta from all parts of the world. And we sort of follow them throughout the season and sort of telling their stories of both the players individually and the team as a collective. So it's sort of like, you know, our version of Last Chance U that most people are familiar with Netflix. This is our version essentially on our YouTube channel, OTE Movies. You know, and like I think I mentioned earlier, before about the kind of content that we're creating, it's you know, it's like it's a mix of like long form docuseries that you're used to and accustomed to, with sort of like a touch of you know, our content creators who are sort of familiar and have a background in like sort of creating like hype. So that is where like the motion graphics and the more sped up sort of you know, producing comes into effect, because obviously we realize who our audience is. Then there's the second aspect of things, like I mentioned about the live production that we do, is we broadcast all of our games here at OTE. It's amazing and crazy to think that OTE started shooting videos on their cell phones, and now they're basically running full game productions with out of a control room that you mostly see, that will sort of equivalent of what you would expect to see out of a you know, an RSN or even a national, you know, sports broadcast network. And the only difference there, the way we approached it, is we realized who our audience is, and what we decided to do is sort of merge our talent. And we don't like to call them announcers or broadcasters, but we like to call them, you know, they're actually really influencers. You know, they've got a great following on YouTube because that's where our platform is. That's where we sort of put our games on. We don't put necessarily anything that's live. We put recaps of our games, but they're basically condensed versions of our live broadcast. You know, interestingly enough, we used our broadcasters to be the AMP group. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the AMP group, but they're huge on YouTube with a large following on YouTube. And for us, it's like a perfect marriage to bring people who are familiar with the AMP guys, you know, in that world in YouTube, and bring that on to our broadcast, because we wanted to do essentially the untraditional ways of doing a broadcast, in the sense of not having your traditional play-by-play, not having your traditional caller analyst, and also not having your traditional sideline reporter, because we just wanted to be different. And we know that our audience is looking for something different. So we went, you know, completely against the grain of what people would be expecting to see in a broadcast. And I'll give a funny story. We had, you know, Julius Dr. J. Irving on one of our games recently, and I can't say that our fan base is, you know, that excited, even though he's a Hall of Fame and a legend in the game of basketball. And obviously, yeah, I'm excited and I've met him before. But then our AMP guys walk into the building and they're like rock stars and superstars, where all the kids and our fans are going crazy, wanting to take pictures and selfies. So that just kind of shows you the difference between our sort of like our demographic and sort of how we do things here at Overtime Elite, essentially.
So you talked about how many brands Overtime Sports has now. And I was wondering what the challenge was like about coordinating content across those brands, specific for those brands, or working for multiple brands. Is it kind of like working for a team where it's like, can this fit in multiple platforms? Or is it kind of, we've got to be a little bit more specific on a per platform basis?
Yeah, so there's teams working on every different platform, whether it be on the OTE season on the football side of things, here on the overall branded stuff, on the branded content stuff, whether it's here on OTE, whether it's on the Overtime platform, whether it's on the Overtime Fits, you name it. And then a lot of the stuff, like you said, we do. Like if we put it on the long form, then we'll create a version that will go on, whether it's on Snapchat, TikTok, IG, et cetera, et cetera. So yes, it translates to both, but literally like every avenue. It's amazing how fast this company is growing, especially since we created this hub here in Atlanta. That it's primarily focused on all OTE branded stuff that we're doing. And then they've got an entire team that's on in New York that's, you know, sort of weaved into the other platforms that and other channels that Overtime is doing. And there's a whole team out in LA that's working on stuff as well. So, you know, obviously now we're getting into like the Overtime betting avenue as well. So that there's a whole team that's just working on that as well. So it's incredible, you know, how, you know, we're literally pulling people such incredible backgrounds. And if you just like, saw the type of backgrounds that Overtime the staff have, it's absolutely incredible. So many talented people from so many different avenues. It's unbelievable.
You touched on a little bit there, by the way, the motion graphics angle was a good angle for me. But you touched on different kinds of content. How has that been different for you? And how do you approach the content that to hit the right audience with the product, different products, because as we've talked about, it's definitely been different than your traditional, quote unquote, traditional, I guess.
The way I look at it is I'm bringing the same elements that I love. So I'm big on sound design. I'm big on shooting something incredibly beautifully and cinematically, bringing all those elements still in. That's what I harp on for my content team all the time. Like, we have to shoot things incredibly. I'm a strong believer, like in any piece that you do, I call it the rewind moment. Like you have to watch something and somebody needs to like pause, go back 15 seconds because that shot was so dope that you wanted to watch it again. So like having that cinematic sort of like angle and, you know, like mind frame in everything that we shoot. And yeah, we look for people who have incredible, we don't expect all of our content creators and producers to have that sort of motion graphics background. But when I was building my team, I was looking for people who had that background. Initially, I got two of them who I think were incredibly gifted, who basically take a piece who is still very strong and adding those sort of motion graphics to it. Just adds an extra spice to it that is very, very enticing. It's almost like bringing the world of like our content creators of this young generation who are so big into like hypes, and then also taking our long form content people and sort of merging those like hype creators and long form feature creators and bringing them together, and then sort of like merging them together. So you still have a long form piece. It just has a feel of like a hype where everything is moving very fast and it's like high colors and has a lot of cool, very motion graphics to it. That is kind of like the formula. And it was sort of like grabbing that audience very early on and then sort of making these like marks as you go along in the episode where you're constantly like sort of pushing your viewers like, hey, like if you're about to click off or if your head's about to drop, you know, we'll, it's almost like timing it perfectly that will push you right through another like kind of like scene or a segment that you'll keep watching. And before you know it, like you'll watch the entire episode and you'll be like, wow, that was really good. That is the message that I sort of push to my content team on a daily basis. And when we're creating and how we're trying to like, sort of like, you know, put stuff out for our audience.
And going back a little bit too, you had mentioned that you have a team that responds to pretty much every comment that's made on social. I'm curious, because I don't think a lot of teams have that depth and capability. Does that help cut down or limit the negativity that you get as well?
Probably. That's a good question. That would be a question to probably our social people, who can probably answer that way better than I do. But I don't know. I think, just think about it. Like, if you've ever put a comment on something, like if you're a fan of like whatever team or anything for that matter, and somebody actually responds, you don't expect somebody to like respond to you from a brand or like a following that's got like 1 million plus followers, right? Like, you don't expect somebody like, hey, thanks Brock for, yeah. Or like, if you said like, oh, this was really dope, it's like, hey, appreciate you, Brock. Thanks for the comment. Like, keep watching. Or, hey, Justin, you know, shout out Overtime or something like that on the reply. You don't expect that. But like, if you're like a kid or a teenager or something like that, and somebody responds to you, it's like, you almost feel like, you know, like you're like, there's like somebody behind, you know, like there's actually like a human person that's like behind the product, if that makes sense. And there's like that connection, like, right? Like that somebody one took the time to respond to you, to read your, whether it's the negative comment or plus comment. And we take them all. Like, that's how you best know like your audience and like what they want. It's like, you take the good with the bad. If there's something that they don't like, then you're like, okay, there's a lot of people that are kind of like, I'm not feeling this. Like, how can we make this better? And how can we change things? That's what customer service is all about, right? Like, you know, like, you can't like expect to produce something and expect, if you've got like 100,000 people watching it or even more, you can't expect every single person to like it, right? But like, you take the good with the bad. Like, every producer knows that, right? Like, that's the, you know, like, that's what we got in this. And you have to have like thick skin to have in this industry. And sometimes people, you know, like, will hate something that you do. And a lot of people will like what you do. So you just kind of have to take it with a grain of salt and like, hey, like, you know, cool. Like, you're not here to please everybody, right? Like, we'd be, you know, we'd be driving ourselves crazy if that was the case. But like, you have to appreciate it and you have to be receptive to even the negative comments, because that's how you learn and that's how you grow.
When it comes to creating content for not only TikTok, but some of the other channels that are geared towards your younger audience, because that really is where your focus is, how do you take the content, or do you take the content that you're producing and find a way to cut it up in a different way? Or are you producing straight up, like, all the way, every different format or different app has a different execution?
Yeah, we cut it down specifically. So our social team will take, we'll send them the raws of what we do, and they will cut it up and pick, you know, specifically catered for their audience. And our social team knows, you know, their audience better than obviously I do. Our job is more like on the digital YouTube side for the longer episodic kind of stuff that we do. And part of the process is then sort of cutting it down, like in terms of like sending them a raw. And then they use that part for cut down specifically for the specific platforms that they're going to put it on.
So your social media people are also video editors or have a background in some way, shape, or form into creating content?
Yeah, we've got, whether it's our social team that's up in New York, that works hand in hand with our social team that's over here, headed by Ryan Rossi, who comes from Under Armour, and he's got about 4 people on there, his staff, which he's still growing his staff as well. And they're completely intertwined with our athletes. Like, it's amazing. You walk around this facility and then you might see our social guys like playing horse or shooting hoops with our athletes on the side, which is incredible, because like, they've got such an incredible, and we're talking about access and we're talking about relationship with NBA athletes and MLS athletes. It's a whole other level here at OT, which is absolutely incredible on the amount of one access and the proximity and the closest that we have with these athletes.
Awesome. I think jumping in and understanding a little bit more about what you look for, you did touch on looking for diversity and different backgrounds when you are looking to hire people. Can you expand a little bit more on more specifically, like what people can do to stand out?
Yeah, for sure. Before I even get to the point of standing out, I can focus on diversity, because it's very, very important to me. Just because I think I've mentioned it earlier, I think it's just overall, it makes a team better. Like, the more diverse you are, the better your team is, period. you know, like the easy part in. And I've been in this process now in my second job and looking for people to hire, whether it's in my previous job at LAFC and now at Overtime. It'd be easy to just go into your inbox of people who are applying for jobs and basically, you know, who are the applicants who are applying for this particular job that you have? If you have a producer, shooter, editor position, for instance, like who are the applicants and going through just those applicants and going through and hiring. But to be honest with you, the majority of the people that I've hired have all been, I would say about 85% have been handpicked by myself, where I literally went out and scoured and looked for them. And it's whether it's I'm scouring LinkedIn or whether I'm like going through social media channels, whether it's Twitter, Instagram, you have, and literally stalking people and seeing the kind of work that they're posting. But more specifically, I'm looking for people, for diverse people. The easy part would be, like I said earlier, like going through that inbox and just basically skimming through like the applicants. But I'm, you know, like if you look at our industry, and whether if you're going through like LinkedIn, and I've gone through this, like, you know, I don't, there's not a lot of like diversity because there's not a lot of good hiring diversity, whether it's like, you know, like, there's not a lot of people that look like myself. There's not a lot of people. There's not a lot of women applicants in this sports industry. So my job, and I take, you know, I take this seriously, but I go above and beyond by not just going the easy route. The easy route would just be going like, hey, these are the applicants that are applied to the jobs and these are the best candidates and I'll hire them. But no, if I don't have enough of a pool of a diversity, it's my job. And I encourage and I urge every person that's in a position to hire on their content team. Like if you've got, I don't know, 10 applicants for a job and they all look the same, it's your job and your responsibility to go out there then or to turn to your HR team and say, hey, I need to like, you know, I need to even out this playing pool of field of pool by having 10 candidates that look like this, 10 candidates like look like that. I need 10 women candidates on this pool. Otherwise, I am not going to make a hire based on just who applied for jobs or what's it called. I'm going to make sure that I've got as diverse of a pool to pick from before I make a decision. So I go out of my way by finding, you know, specifically women to bring on my team. I don't like to use the word people of color, but like non-white people on my team because I think it's important. And I will just go out there and then like look for them. And I will take all the time in the world that's need to before that happens. But I'm not going to go the easy route and just hiring people on my team just because those are the people who are applying for jobs, because that would be a cop out and I'm not interested in doing that whatsoever. So as I keep doing that, in terms, I'm still like right now I've hired some people, I'm hiring more and more people. But I'm taking my time. It's like I'm being very diligent in it, like in finding more people. I'm actually talking to a young man on Monday, which I think is an incredible talent. But again, it's kind of like when I'm scouring like LinkedIn or social media or whatever, like if you're a content creator in that sense, I look at your avatar to see also like in a sense of like who you look like, because I want to make sure like I'm getting a diverse pool, because like I said earlier, it's important for me to like make sure that I am reaching out to as diverse of a pool of people as possible to bring in to pick people. I'm not saying that I'm picking anybody based on specifically on a certain diversity. That it's not something that I do, but I want to make sure that like, my pool of selection is as diverse as possible.
I know we've talked about this on this podcast before, and I know we're passionate about it, but you know, early on in my career, I've told the story before, so I'll be brief with it. But as a manager, I was talking to my manager about how I was disappointed that our candidate pool wasn't very diverse. And he just asked me, well, what did you do to make it diverse? And I was like, well, I didn't do anything. Right. And that was very eye opening. Right. So I think you're spot on. You have to go out and scour, you know, and make sure you're recruiting a diverse candidate pool, because it's not just going to fall into your lap, right? I feel like that's an obligation as a manager, as somebody who's a hiring manager. On top of that too, sometimes these people may not be in sports yet, right? And they may be looking to get into sports, or they may have adjacent skill sets. And I've always been a big fan of hiring people over skill sets. But you kind of have to get outside of your box, and maybe this person doesn't have this specific experience with this editing style, right? But they have an adjacent experience. It's maybe not in sports, or it's maybe in sports in a different area, right? But they still could be a good fit. But I think, you know, I just wanted to echo that. I think you're hitting the nail on the head. You have to be active about it because it's just not going to fall on your lap and nothing's going to change in the industry if you're not actively combating it. Right.
I agree. And I did the same thing in LAFC, you know, like in Major League Soccer, like I mentioned with our sideline reporter and making sure she was bilingual and she had a background in speaking Spanish. But it was also with, you know, in LAFC, we had a rotating sort of color analyst where, we basically had a different color analyst for every game. But even in that sense, like I wanted to make sure that we had like a diversity. I remember a conversation I want to say it was with some of our on-air talent. And I think we just ended up either like the World Cup was going on or something. And I think Fox Sports at the time was just trying out some Spanish speaking announcers on a World Cup game. And obviously, but it was an English broadcast. So obviously they had a heavy accent and all that kind of stuff. And people were talking about like, oh my God, it was cringing. I mean, I couldn't listen to it. It was like, oh my God, why don't they just get some proper English speaking people to do the broadcast? And I was just like, do you guys realize one about how our demographic of our country is? And if there's some kid who is, you know, speaks Spanish and has an accent that watches that broadcast and gets inspired by it because he saw those two announcers and they've got one, they look like me. Two, they sound like me. That is like, you know, representation is so important. And I don't think people realize that or see that. And that is why it's important. It's the same thing within this sport. Like, you know, whether we're in the NBA or football, like predominantly of our athletes are, you know, they're Black athletes. You know, it's unbelievable to me that like not understanding like our content creators, like maybe like they will have a closer relationship, a lot more of a comfort level with, you know, like content creators, like one will like maybe like look like them and they feel like they can understand him in that sense. And I don't have to point out any situations with certain sports scenes, but you guys, we've seen it over the years about how many times these certain sports scenes have taken like an L either in social media or in some point where like they just missed the mark because somewhere in the room, they didn't have somebody in that room to tell them like, hey, I'm not sure that this is going to hit right. Like maybe we should reevaluate this or think about something differently. And the reason is like, if you're looking around in your content team and you're looking around and everybody looks just like you, that's a problem. So as long as I guess I'm in a position to hire, as long as it's on my watch, like, you know, I will take that responsibility to make sure that my teams are as like diverse as possible. And, you know, I take pride in that. It's important to me. Like, you know, that's just something that I just want to do. And I'm continuing to do that here at Overtime as well.
And you've mentioned that you, when you seek people out, how do you approach that? Obviously they have to be doing the work and putting the work out there for you to find them, mm-hmm. and see that and be, and want to reach out to them. So how do they get on your radar?
I just search, like I look for, whatever the keywords are, content creators, I look to see like what their past experience. I mean, Brock made a good point, like my motion graphics guy that I hired, he's an incredible talent, but he had no background in sports. He was doing, whether he was doing music videos and he was doing something, he was working for like an antique store before I hired him. But like, I saw the stuff that he put out on his website and I was like, this guy is incredible. Like, and I just reached out to him and kind of, he's not into sports. He's never been into sports. But, you know, it would be great if he had a background in sports, but I don't think that's necessarily a requirement. If you're a good producer, you're a good filmmaker or cinematographer, it should translate to any avenue that you do, right? And it's the same way that I tell people who have a sports background, like, don't lock yourself just in this industry. Like, you guys have been in this, I've been in so long. It can be maddening. Like, it might, like, you know, I think there's a sense now that like a lot of people are leaving our industry, right? Because they're like, people are getting burnt out and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, if you're a good producer and you're a good filmmaker or cinematographer, like maybe you go venture out and you do your own thing. Maybe all of a sudden you're doing sports and all of a sudden you wanted to travel, take that skill set and go travel the world and be like a travel filmmaker or something like that, in that sense. But when I reach out to people, I'll look and search on Instagram. I'll look to see what, you know, maybe if like I follow a content creator and I'll look to see what other people are commenting on their posts and I'll see like, you know, because a lot of creative people are sort of like running the same circles, right? So you see what other people, who are their friends, who are their people they're connected with and all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, I kind of just check out their stuff and their work. I'll say the biggest thing for me, if you have a reel and you've got some links on your webpage, if I'm giving advice to any content creator, if you want to be found, like, make sure you have a website, make sure you have a reel, because if like, I've reached out to so many people and I'm like, hey, can I see your reel? Can I see your work? It's like, oh, I don't have one. That's like, it's incredible to me. Like, you should. How else are you going to be, like, how is somebody going to find you? Like, you know, you have to like show off your work, whether it's on social media. And nowadays, like, people do such an incredible job. Like, people just post their stuff on social media. It's like so easy to follow. So, and to find. So I think that's great. And then actually, I just send them like an email and I just say like, hey, I tell them about myself. I tell them about what we're doing here at Overtime. I specify, I think, I wonder what they think about when I say, hey, I'm trying to put a very diverse content group. But what I mean by that, I'm obviously looking for a diversity in terms of like the makeup of our team, but I'm also looking for diversity in terms of like their skill sets. So if you're a really good editor, if you're a really good producer, if you're a really good shooter, like, I believe in sort of bringing everybody in together where everybody will want for once push each other to like become better. But like, you can take stuff from other people. Like, if you're not that great of an editor, like, sit next to somebody who's like a great editor and learn something. If you're a great producer, you can learn from that. If you're a great shooter, you can learn from that person. So I'm not looking for like an all around great person in like one avenue, but if you're a great producer, if you're a great shooter, but you're not a great editor, that's fine. Like, you know, I feel like we've got enough great, incredible, talented people that like, over time, and it's my job to help you grow and become a better editor if you're not a great editor, right? Like, that is, I'm going to put you in a position to obviously where you succeed, but where you also grow at the same time.
I just love that you have the dual background. I feel like for so long, people told me like, well, you got to specialize in one or the other. It's like, well, I like doing both. I ended up specializing in live. That's what I did. And now I'm an engineer, so I'm don't even do that really, you know, but it's like, I like doing all of it. There's crossover. And I think people just miss that crossover a lot.
Yeah, I agree. And like I said, I was fortunate. I know a lot of people in my past who were just focused on live producing, and that is all they knew how to do. You put them in front of a computer with a mouse and a keyboard to edit, and they wouldn't know what to do with it. But I was fortunate, like, at the time when I started at The Heat, they needed somebody who could like produce features and have like sort of storytelling ability, and which I loved. And I used that until they felt that I was ready to like sit on the hot chair and be a producer. And I did all those things. I was font coordinating. I was ADing in the truck, all that kind of stuff. I sat in like every chair before I finally sat in the big chair. But at the same time, I was doing stuff back in the studio and in producing and editing and all that kind of stuff. So that's why, to me, it's a skill set as an executive producer. When I talk to my editors and I review stuff and I give them notes, right? And they're rolling their eyes like, oh, he wants me to take this out. He wants me to change that. Like, right? Like, I've been there before. I can relate to you guys in that sense, right? Like, that's the biggest thing I always try to harp with them. Like, I've been there. I know what it's like. And I think they respect
the
that, right?
Same language, right?
Yeah.
It's like, way better when you speak the same language.
So they know I understand, I can relate to them. And I've gone through it all. I've like, whether it's in my young age of being like burnt down and like making sure like I don't have that work-life balance and that, you know, personal life balance, like all that kind of stuff. Like, when I'm hiring people, I'm talking to them, and like, two individuals who I recently hired both left sports, collegiate sports, because they felt burnt out in their respective athletic department. One went to work for a church organization. Another one went to go on his own, basically do his own business. And I told him, like, I promise you, I will not burn you out. I know what it's like. It's my responsibility, and it's on me to make sure that, one, you have a workplace where you're growing and I'm investing in you, but at the same time, you're happy to come every single day. And I take that seriously, and I stand by that. You know, so far it's still early on, but that's also my job when I'm still hiring more people. The more people I get to hire, I get to alleviate a little bit less pressure on the rest of my staff, where they can have a little bit more of a great balance, where can they just come to work, do their stuff, be creative, and go home and like talk about it, like without and enjoy it, and not necessarily take work with them when you're like, man, today was a long day, you know, that kind of stuff. So, and we've all been there. And like I said, so I don't want them to feel that. Because I think the industry is changing. I think back in the days, it was kind of like a given where like sports life was everything and the only thing. And you had to dedicate your whole life, especially, I mean, Justin, you know, at the NBA, it's 82 game season. You got playoffs, you got finals, man, those four runs that I had with LeBron when he was around, man, those were crazy. Going all the way into like June, like, yeah, I had no time for anything. At that time, I had a girlfriend. I'm trying to think of even I saw her enough, to be honest with you. but it was tough. But I don't want my staff to go through that because I don't think that's right. So it's important for them to be happy to come in every day to go to work without necessarily feeling like they're overworked.
Well, thank you so much for making Creative Sports Podcast part of your day. We'd love to hear your thoughts, feedback, and suggestions, so pop on over to the Sports Creative Community on Slack and connect with us and your fellow creatives. If you're enjoying this podcast, we'd love it if you shared it with a friend or a coworker, and leave us a 5-star rating so other people will be able to find us as well. And don't forget to subscribe so that you're the first person to catch each new episode. Remember, the world needs your voice, so keep creating.